This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 20th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on the program, a crusade of sorts to convince people an energy-saving home is worth an investment, a preview of the next KUAF Fulbright Summer Chamber Music Festival concert, and the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts will spend a week preparing for Robin Hood. Also, a chance to win two free tickets to see Little Feat at George's Majestic Lounge Saturday night. First, this morning, the Economic Opportunity Agency of Washington County held a grand opening for EOA Children's House. The facility is now the largest long-term child abuse treatment and prevention center in the country. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda was at the Springdale Center this morning and talked to Michael Lanier, executive director for EOA Washington County, and Ben McClintock, the director of development for EOA.
How long have you been working on this project?
We started about 7 years ago in the planning process. We've been wanting to do this for years, and we just have never felt that we were in a financial position to do it. And finally, 7 years ago, the board of directors decided that we were just going to do what it took to do it. And so we started out in the design process and then with Ben, and started with him and started raising the funds through the Campaign for Children. And the years went fast, and then actually we started building when?
The construction actually started on December 7th, 2009.
Okay. And so here we are.
All right. Today is the grand opening, so how's everybody feeling to have this project finally completed?
Today is nothing short of a victory for EOA Children's House, for EOA as an entire organization. But the true victors and beneficiaries of all of this are going to be the children, the ones that come here every day and year after year to receive treatment, because the treatment that they will receive in this facility is really unequaled in the nation. We really set out to do something that was not only groundbreaking locally and regionally, but something nationally. And this center is the largest long-term child abuse treatment and prevention center in the United States of America. This is something that is not only something that is truly groundbreaking and a tremendous resource and asset to Northwest Arkansas and the children of Northwest Arkansas, but is something that we think is going to be a game changer for the entire state of Arkansas. Now, this is going to be something that is going to hopefully go a long way towards changing the way the rest of the country perceives the natural state and how it feels and deals with the problem of child abuse.
So how does this building differ from your previous facility, and what does that mean in terms of the care you'll be able to provide?
Oh, this building is so much nicer. Our previous building was very, very small. We were having to do services in hallways. Our old building would literally fit into where we have our main atrium area. And this building will allow us now to over triple our capacity for the serving children.
Another thing that it's going to be able to do is beyond just the service capacity increase that Mike mentioned, and more than doubling our service area with us being located in Springdale and being able to more adequately have a transportation network that encompasses all of the major population centers in Northwest Arkansas. The third primary goal that we wanted to be able to accomplish beyond expanding our service area and expanding our service capacity was eliminating our age cutoff of 18 months of age. One out of every three children in the United States right now that's being abused and neglected is under the age of three. And in the old center, we were only able to capture half of that population. The new center, this center, the Pat Walker Center for Children, has an infant wing that actually can provide long-term child abuse rehabilitative therapy for abused children as young as 6 weeks of age. So we have essentially completely eliminated that age limitation that the old center had. And one thing that I would also like to note is that the way we feel about the Pat Walker Center for Children, the new home of EOA Children's House, is that this isn't our center. This isn't EOA's center. This is the community center. The community built this facility. This center was built entirely with funds raised from private sources. There's not a single tax dollar or public dollar involved in the construction of this facility. And this center is here for Northwest Arkansas because of Northwest Arkansas. And this is something that has been a huge responsibility that has been entrusted to EOA as an organization, and we take that very seriously, and every day we are humbled and honored to have that responsibility.
Antoinette Grajeda was at the grand opening of the EOA Children's House in Springdale this morning, and while there she talked with Michael Lanier, Executive Director for EOA Washington County, and Ben McClintock, the Director of Development for EOA. This is Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. Sunday, there will be an unusual scavenger hunt at the home of Orlo and Mary Stitt. Participants will seek out energy-saving features at their house. The event is sponsored by Arkansas Interfaith Power and Light, a group dedicated to inspiring more sustainable choices. Recently, our energy correspondent Christina Thomas met with Orlo Stitt and talked to him about his career in energy-conscious development and why he's turning his own home into a scavenger hunt.
Orlo Stitt has always loved the outdoors and science and growing things, everything from gardens to rabbits. That love is how he wound up in Northwest Arkansas. As one of five children, his father had brought him to the Ozarks on camping trips for hiking, boating, and swimming. His company, Stitt Energy, found its home in Rogers in 1978. Before settling here, Orlo went to school in Iowa. He first studied chemical engineering and then followed his passion, going back to school to study biology and ecology. He also has an MBA. An environmentally conscious company he worked for at the time sent him to Canada on assignment. He and his wife Mary were young and enthusiastic and stayed long after the 18-month project.
We built a house in suburban Montreal. Right on the lake where the Ottawa River and the St. Lawrence River come together. And on an island, which used to be truly an island, only accessible by boat, then they built a small bridge to it. And it's called Ville Ilcadieu, V-I-L-L-E-I-L-E-C-A-D-I-E-U-X, Island of Guests. And it was a vacation area where people would boat. We started the house in 1972, and in 1973, the oil embargo came when OPEC was forming, gathering strength and muscle to actually control a monopoly. And that's oil supplies for the world. And at that time, our house, which was energy planned, sustainable, all the things that I had been studying and practicing were kind of put into my own little creation. And it was on primetime television, both in the U.S. and Canada. And that's really the springboard.
The house had passive solar, a solar water heater, and super insulation. It was way ahead of its time. After living in Canada for some time, Orlo realized that he wanted to become an entrepreneur, heading south to found his company. Today, his office is in the same rustic wooden rock office on 71B it was in at its founding. Stitt Energy remains a leader in building energy-efficient homes.
Our mission statement today is the same as it was in 1978, to provide energy-efficient homes that are environmentally responsible for the satisfaction, health, welfare, and happiness of our customers, our employees, our investors, and future generations. So that's still what we focus on. New home construction has changed some here recently with banking and the economy and foreclosures, and there's still low interest rates. There's a lot of good deals out there. But new construction has slowed, although we are still staying reasonably busy.
The company also does remodels, or energy retrofits. Those projects make up half of their current workload. Stitt Energy employs about 15 people, up from the three that were there at its inception. They have built in 18 different states, though 75% of their homes are within a 300-mile radius of Rogers. Among many other things, Orlo is a builder. but he also possesses an enthusiasm for education. He believes that one reason more people aren't on the sustainability bandwagon is a lack of knowledge. So he has written a book titled Holistically Green Homes.
A matter of people understanding, educating, caring, making a commitment. And the first chapter in there is to make a commitment. And I think commitment comes from understanding. Once you make a commitment, then behavior follows.
He says that the book is an open documentation of his experiences.
Not just for the 33 years we've been here, but for the 12 or 14 years prior to that, because really my whole career from the time I was in school to the time I got out, even as a child, has been focused on conservation. And
it is also his gift to the generations that follow.
So it's my legacy. It's to everybody. It's to communicate what can be done more efficiently and actually end up with a better lifestyle, a happier one, one that you're in touch with nature, one that you're in touch with outdoors every morning.
It is a book written for everyone. As Orlo says, it's not for the choir, but for the people that aren't in the church. As the title suggests, the book is also about building homes, better homes, and how to do it economically.
We don't tell people they're less expensive to build. We say that it's a good investment and that there's a whole section on economics. That's probably one of the things that people question the most. Well, okay, my associate at work or my neighbor or my father or somebody says, oh gosh, you know, you never get your money back, the payback's too long and all that. Well, the book explains that if you do it right, you start getting your money back the month after you move in.
Orlo also wants to show that energy-efficient homes are beautiful and look like normal houses. He has included pictures of the homes of many satisfied customers. To affirm that environmentally friendly homes are aesthetically pleasing, he and his wife Mary have invited the public to their own home in South Sun Estates, a subdivision they developed on Beaver Lake. The event is in partnership and benefits the organization Interfaith Power and Light, a nonprofit working with churches, spreading the motto, Caring for Creation. Orlo explains a bit about the event, to be held Sunday.
And we invite everybody to come out and to our house. We're going to have scavenger hunt, not for trinkets or whatever, but for green energy features. And we'll give them a little card and a scorecard, and they can find the features and put the right number on their scorecard.
Participants will be looking for about 80 features. Things like window shades that control the sun coming in and can act as an insulator. Trees, depending on the type, can also help control energy use. When the scorecards have been tallied, various prizes will be up for grabs.
We've got compact fluorescent light bulbs and a cooker from the gas company. A smoker, I guess is the right word.
Orlo's book will be available for purchase, all proceeds benefiting the organization. While the educational event is free, donations will be accepted.
Caring for Creation and Interfaith Power and Light is really a movement, and I think churches are meant to promote good things, things that make people not just religious, but to be sharing and caring. And I think there is a ministry of energy or conservation or sharing that comes with energy. And it's for now, but also for the future.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Christina Thomas is energy correspondent for Ozarks at Large. Her work is supported in part by Energy Corps.
Earth, sky.
The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts a busy 2011 season for Atlantic hurricanes. Earth Sky spoke with Chris Landsea, the Science and Operations Officer at the National Hurricane Center.
The forecast that we just came out with is 6 to 10 hurricanes and an average hurricane season is about 6 hurricanes. What we don't know, though, is where they form, what we call the genesis locations, or the steering that'll show up once there's a hurricane out there.
The climate pattern known as La Niña is one of the forces of nature driving hurricanes in 2011, said Lancy.
And La Niña is cooler than normal waters in the eastern Pacific. That actually has a remote effect where cooler waters there promote more hurricanes in the Atlantic because it tends to reduce the amount of wind shear that tears apart the storms and allows more thunderstorms to develop.
An important point, added Lancy, is that not all hurricanes that form at sea make it to land and to the people who live along the coast.
The second factor is we've been in enhanced activity since 1995. Both because of the reduced vertical wind shear as well as warmer waters, and that appears to still be in place for 2011 as well.
More at our website. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
It's Monday, June 20th, 2011. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Baker-Martin. She's the editor of What's Up?, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
I find it almost inconceivable to think that our listeners have not had enough music in the last few weeks.
You can always have more music.
Well, yes, you can, and we do.
Okay.
Efren White is at JJ's Grill and Chill in Fayetteville tonight.
Wonderful songwriter.
Mo Brothers, who does a great show, is at JJ's Grill and Chill in Rogers tonight. Sarah Hughes is at Mojo's Pints and Pies in Fayetteville tonight.
She was just inside this very studio a few days ago.
And
wonderful.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got a few concerts that you might want to think about traveling to. On Wednesday, Motley Crue performs at the Verizon Wireless Amphitheater in St. Louis.
Okay.
You should see the enthusiasm on Kyle's face. How about Vans Warped Tour?
Sure.
On Friday,
mm-hmm.
at the...
Who's on the Vans Warped Tour roster?
I don't have
okay.
a clue.
Right.
I go see Trout Fishing in America. Okay. That's the
All
extent
right.
of my
okay.
musical knowledge. But Vans Warped Tour is in Dallas on Friday. The Steve Miller Band mm-hmm. is at the Memphis Botanic Garden on Saturday.
Hmm.
And Elvis Costello is at Crossroads, Kansas City on June 30th.
There you go. Now you're talking my language.
So if you haven't seen enough music, check the Events Away listing every week in What's Up. We've always got something.
Declan McManus.
Okay.
That's Elvis Costello's real name. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up?, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And that is my real name.
Residents and businesses in Johnson and Franklin counties continue to clean up after two tornadoes devastated the region the night of May 24th. Five people died and hundreds of homes were destroyed or damaged by the storms. One of the twisters was recorded to be a mile wide with wind speeds of up to 170 miles per hour. The Federal Emergency Management Association has been assessing the situation. A federal disaster declaration would make residents eligible for individual assistance, including temporary housing, grants, and low-interest loans. Fred Mullen is director of Franklin County Emergency Operations.
Over the weekend, we received a message from FEMA that we had been denied individual assistance, which is direct assistance to property owners. And we've been turned down for that. We don't know the reasons why. We have a briefing later on today with representatives of the Arkansas Department of Emergency Management to help us understand why they turned that down. And they've begun an appeals process on that, and we worked over the weekend doing some paperwork to try to reinforce our application. My understanding is that we've turned in everything we were asked to turn in, and the governor's office has forwarded everything that they were asked to forward. But for some reason, officials at FEMA say that we do not meet the minimum standards to have a federal disaster declaration, and I don't know the reasons, specific reasons why.
Franklin, Johnson, and a portion of Logan County were denied federal aid, Mullen said. He says the state will pitch in with some assistance, but they really need the federal contribution. Johnson County is reporting around 230 homes damaged or destroyed, half of them uninsured. And of the 130 homes reported damaged or destroyed in Franklin County, as many as three quarters were uninsured.
As your listeners already know, we had a EF4 tornado hit part of our county, and then it was scaled at an EF3 that hit another little populated area. We've got over about 100 homes destroyed, and dozens and dozens and dozens with severe damage to them. About 350, 400 people essentially without a home of their own in the county, and about 1,500 people impacted. Folks, neighbors, helping neighbors, trying to clean their farms and their home sites up. Lots of volunteer help still coming in to try to get things organized and straightened up. And a lot of donations still coming in that we need very much so these people can, have a living and try to replace some of what they lost.
Franklin County Emergency Manager Fred Mullen says they continue to need and welcome volunteers and donations, especially food and cleanup supplies like safety goggles, heavy gloves, and tools. For more information, 479-667-4127, or in Johnson County, 479-754-6383.
This again, This American Life. Julian's appendix just burst, which he says is a weird thing to happen because...
it's your appendix, which doesn't even, up to that point, have a job. You know what I mean? It's the only organ in your body that doesn't do anything. So it's a little weird that it's the first one to be like, this. Because other organs, like your liver is like, really?
That's this week.
You're the one that's had it up to here.
This American Life, Saturday mornings at 6 and Sunday mornings at 10, each weekend on KUAF 91.3 FM. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, the 20th day of June, 2011. Saturday, Paul Ciprocchi will host visitors to his farm on the eastern edge of Fayetteville. There will be a potluck in conjunction with the tour, and the event is a collaboration between several local organizations and individuals. Recently, Paul Ciprocchi came to KUAF to explain why he's letting people traipse about his farm. Also with us for the conversation was Pauline Thiessen, produce manager at Ozark Natural Foods. This is called a slow food farm tour. Which, right? Do I have
yes,
that right?
You do.
Pauline, that makes me think that I'm going to be able to tour a farm.
That's the idea. We wanted to take the idea of a potluck and a farm tour and combine them together so that we could kind of go full circle with the food. People could eat it together. They could see how it grows. You know, you can see the whole process.
So tell me chronologically what will happen when I show up.
Sure. 5:30 to 6:30 is the potluck and mingling time. It kind of allows people to filter in as they see fit. And 6:30 to 7:30 is the farm tour, which Paul will be leading. And then from 7:30 to 8 is the CSA presentation with desserts.
Paul,
yes,
we're going to be at your farm.
That's right.
And that is where?
We are located 1 mile on Highway 45 off of Crossover and Mission. So we are about 1 mile from the Crossover intersection just outside the Fayetteville city limits.
So help me out. What will be experienced on the tour?
Well, the tour is just going to be a great opportunity for us to showcase what we've been doing for the last year and a half on our farm. It will include a tour of our gardens, what kind of vegetables are growing, including tomatoes, cucumbers, basil, peppers, potatoes, carrots, arugula, all kinds of fun stuff. So we're going to walk people through the farm, show them what we're growing, how we're growing it. We will also spend some time focusing on another aspect of our farm, which is sustainability. Last year we started with sustainability workshops, and we built a solar greenhouse with straw bale construction. So there'll be an opportunity to walk and talk and look at the straw bale solar greenhouse, talk about how it was designed, how it was built, how we use local straw. Secondly, we will do a walk through our hoop house, which we also had a workshop, and we built it last year, and it allowed us to grow food all the way into February. We actually harvested over 40 pounds of lettuce in February after the big snows and sold to the local restaurant, the Greenhouse Grill, for their Valentine's Day special. So we'll get a chance to learn about how we can extend our season with the hoop house. And then also we'll do a little tour around my victory garden, and we have dedicated ourselves to sustainability on this farm, working towards small scale. So our house is outfitted with solar panels. So we have solar panels, we have rain catch, we have a small victory garden, and then we have a larger operation that we do for our CSA.
CSA, of course, the
community-supported agriculture.
Thank you. Yeah. The community was what was and that's when people can literally, figuratively, buy in to the farm, and it's delivered. Do you do doorstep delivery?
We actually do. That's something that we decided would be a perk for folks who maybe never had heard of a community-supported agriculture, how it works. Most farms that have CSAs, the members actually come to the farm. But the fact that our farm is unique and we have many other residents that rent there, we didn't want to impact the farm by having 20 to 40 members showing up every week for 6 months.
We're neighbors, by the way.
So you appreciate the door.
So we decided that a delivery service would really pique a lot of people's interest. It is something that we've had to work for about 4 months to educate folks here locally about what a CSA is, and we felt one easy transition would be, we're actually going to show up at your door and bring you this food that's grown locally.
You do radishes?
We do.
We'll have to talk. Teresa, do you hope that the people who show up here maybe... oh, well, maybe I can do a hoop house, or maybe I can learn more about growing. But there are going to be some people who show up who live in apartments or don't have that, and maybe are just going for the awareness or a learning.
Well, and yeah, just the entertainment or the joy of visiting a farm and meeting your farmer. Because, I mean, if you have an apartment and you want to get fresh local produce or you can't make it to the market, you can sign up for a CSA. And then you have a chance now to come meet Paul and Jesse, the people who are growing the food for you, so you can connect to your local food source.
Paul, did you always – what's your history with farming?
Well, I've been farming – this is our fifth year farming. My partner Amanda and I, after we had our first children, we decided this was important. Organic food, local, is very, very important to us. And we started about 5 years growing food with a little small two-row garden. And 5 years later, you know, we're supplying local restaurants, local grocery stores, and starting the CSA. So I have a very limited background in growing, but we've been very dedicated in the last 5 years learning from other local farmers, gleaming as much information from them, and trying to get as far as we can, as quickly as we can, so we can work towards that being our full-time work.
What's been the biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge has been... I don't know if there has been a biggest challenge. There really, it's just a pleasure every day to go out. You know, the biggest challenge is just the physical, taking raw land and turning it into a place where you can grow food. Other farmers actually turned down the opportunity to manage this property because it was covered with many different kinds of grasses that are hard to overcome. So being young and having lots of volunteers, we're a part of a program called the Worldwide Opportunity on Organic Farms. The short version is called WOOF. And WOOF is an opportunity for farmers to host people who want to learn to farm. So we actually house them and feed them, and they come and they stay, and they help work on the farm. They learn from the farmers, and it's just a wonderful relationship. So right now we have people here from Japan. We have people here from New Jersey and from New Mexico.
Wow.
So it's a great opportunity, and so with all the extra help, we've been able to quickly reclaim rows, put in hoop houses, put up structures, and get a lot further than we would have. So I'd say the hardest thing is definitely just the labor getting established in the first year and a half as a new farm.
Wow, that's exciting.
Yeah.
There's potluck is in the title here too.
Yes. So to highlight and celebrate the local foods, we're asking that participants who bring dishes that feature local foods.
What are you going to have a dish?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what it is yet?
I always bring a salad, at least, plus whatever else I come up with.
So if people are interested in the Slow Food Farm Tour and Potluck, what should they do?
Well, we would prefer them to RSVP so we can kind of expect how many people will be out there. And to do that, please just shoot me an email. And it's Pauline, P-A-U-L-I-N-E, at OzarkNaturalFoods.com.
It is rain or shine.
Yeah, we're planning on it.
And it's Saturday the 25th.
Yes.
Anything else people need to bring?
I'd say bring a sun hat, comfortable mm-hmm. shoes to walk around the farm.
It is later in the day, but it is June, so
yeah. Right.
You might want to have a little sun protection since we will be out for an hour touring the farm.
All right. Thank you both very much.
Thanks. All right.
You're welcome.
Pauline Thiessen is produce manager at Ozark Natural Foods, and Paul Chapraki is an owner of Blackberry Farm, located just east of Fayetteville. The farm will be the host for Saturday's Slow Food Potluck and Farm Tour that takes place Saturday evening from 5:30 until 8. If you're interested in attending, you can email Pauline. Her email address again is pauline@ozarknaturalfoods.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Stephen Gates. He is the curator, organizer, insert title of your choosing of the KUAF Fulbright Summer Chamber Music Festival. Stephen, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's always good to be here.
It is a six-week festival, mm-hmm. and we're about to talk about the penultimate.
That's right. We're getting there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rossini, Schubert,
and Webern.
Webern. Okay, who composed in the first half of the 20th century.
Right, right.
The Rossini Quartet, a beautiful piece.
Beautiful piece written. He wrote a set of, I believe, six, I'm not positive on that number, of quartets for the somewhat unlikely combination of two violins, cello, and string bass. You know, your standard when we say string quartet means two violins, viola, and cello. In this case, two violins, cello, and string bass. And one of the reasons, honestly, we're doing the piece is that we have this wonderful string bassist around named Mike Montgomery, who's played with us two or three times already this summer. And this is a piece that I've known about for years, or this set of pieces, and I actually had some of the music, and he did too. And so we're finally getting a chance to do one of them. And it's short and sweet and happy and very typically Rossini.
Most of the concerts start with something that's upbeat and shorter.
Yeah, I just think that's a nice idea. You know, you want to draw people in and make them glad they're there, and instead of scaring them off. And it does, as you point out, our concerts tend to follow a format of something that's, well, I don't really like the word accessible, but accessible will do, something that's tuneful and a lovely piece.
And then the Webern.
And then the Webern. And before people start thinking, well, I don't want to go to this concert if it's got Webern on it, this is a early piece by Webern written for the traditional string quartet that I mentioned, two violins, viola, and cello. And it simply has the title, my German is not great, Langsamer Satz, which means it's just a slow piece for string quartet. It's short, as is almost everything Webern wrote, and it's very, I don't know, the best word I can think of is romantic. It's very pretty, it's very beautiful, it's very lush, and it has a little bit of, you know, you get some hints in there of the direction that Webern would head later on in his life, but a lot of his later pieces are very kind of pointillistic. And this is not at all. This is pretty lush melodies with harmonies. And there are a couple of other pieces by Webern in this vein. One piece I happen to know is for cello and piano. And again, that same kind of, it sounds like he almost came out of the tradition, and I guess he did really, of Mahler and Wagner and that romantic German kind of tradition, although he was a student of Schoenberg's,
right,
and adopted that style later on in his life. I don't know the year it was written or how old he was, but he must have been young. And it's just it's a surprisingly pretty piece with Webern's name on it, let's say. You know, he was a musicologist might say he was an important composer in the early part of the century. And more approachable than some, I would say, even when he got that sort of more 20th century sound kind of thing.
Last week you promised piano was going to be involved in each of the last three concerts, and mm-hmm. you're making good on the promise this time.
Yep. Yep. Last week we did three pieces with piano, and this week we're going to do what is one of my favorite pieces in the world, the Schubert Second Piano Trio in E flat major, written for, of course, violin, cello, and piano. It's quite substantial. It's a long piece, and hence it balances well the first two pieces, both of which are on the short side. Schubert, many people who are listening will know, wrote pieces that tend to be lengthy, but you know, oftentimes when you say, well, that piece is too long, you mean it. But Schubert, for at least my taste, is never too long. He has materials that he works out very thoroughly. We sometimes kid in rehearsal about having to go through every single key before he gets back to the home key or something like that. But he was such a great composer. And all four movements of this trio are absolutely stunning and wonderful, and as I say, this is sort of, for me, one of my life pieces that I have played before in this case, but just would play it every single chance I got, so I'm very happy about getting to play this.
There will be a reception afterwards.
Yes.
It's
free.
Parking is easy.
Parking is easy, and we... if anybody listening, by the way, would like to get on to our mailing list from the music department, and every time we do this, we include a map for parking purposes, they could email me at sgates@uark.edu or call the music office, and we can get them on a mailing list that will have a few little, in the summer anyway, we write a few little notes, just very casual notes, kind of like this, about the program and... has a map of the concert and a reminder, because we changed locations somewhat, a reminder of where it is and how to get there and all of that. And this one is back at Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall with the parking garage on the other side of the street, actually. It's right there.
And when you are on this email list of University of Arkansas Music Performances, you might be surprised just how many opportunities there are, and most of them free or otherwise very inexpensive.
Right. We do the mailing list, we sort of co-opt almost in the summer for our chamber music festival. But during the year, we send out email notices at least once a month listing everything. And there is an awful lot going on. And as you say, virtually all of it, and certainly I think it's fair to say all of it that's in our own concert hall is free. When we play down at Walton Arts Center with the orchestra or the choir or something like that, there's a nominal charge, but it's still not expensive. And it really, even when we charge, I think of it as a real value for the money.
I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah. Stephen, thank you so much.
Thank you. See you next week for the last time.
You bet. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and with me on the phone from her office at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts is Dr. Rosalie Walker-Russell. She's the director of the academy. How are you doing?
I am great. How are you today, Kyle?
Very good. It is summertime.
Yes.
And I know
one of my favorite times of the year.
It is my absolute favorite time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one reason I like it so much is because it's different than the other 9 months.
Yes.
Do you feel
less
that
structure
at the academy?
Oh, yes. I just think it's a fun time of the year. There's less structure, and I think most children and youth want to go to camp. And so summer is the time for camp, and that's where we are.
And I was going to say, and there are camps at the Academy of the Arts.
That's right. We've got two camps coming up. The neat thing about what we do with camps, I think, is that every summer our camp is always the same week. It's always the last week of July, and it's kind of the last big hurrah before kids and parents have to begin to think about going back to school. And so we make it a big deal, that camp week, and we offer two camps during that week. This year, the camp week is July 25th through the 29th. It's Monday through Friday, and we end everything with a big performance on Friday evening, the 29th. And so we're real excited about it all. We always do these two camps. One of them is called Summer Camp Explosion, and that's a extremely popular camp. And this year we have extended the age range. We want to include the little 5-, 6-, and 7-year-olds in this camp. And so they will come every day from 9 until noon, and will get to perform with us at the end of the week. And they'll do the same types of activities that the older kids are doing, for a shorter period of time each day. I think a 5-year-old probably can only stay at camp for a morning.
Sure.
I don't think we probably ought to have them all day. And what we'll do with them during that morning time is that we'll prepare them to sing and dance and act, and they'll do some art activities as well, and then they'll perform with the older kids at the end of the week. Then the rest of the ages, from age 8 all the way through age 16, they're divided up into age groups, you know, for their day. And we have the 8 through 11-year-olds together all day, and then we have the 12 through 16-year-olds together all day. And they're preparing a musical production called Robin Hood and His Adventures.
Which sounds like a heck of a lot of fun.
Oh, yes. And it's fully staged sets. We have a special component this summer in summer camp called costume and set design, and that's for students ages 12 and up. If they just want to come to camp to learn how to do costuming or build sets, they'll be doing the costuming and the set construction for the camp.
Well, I love that, because that means if you don't want to be in stage in front of people, or you have mm-hmm. a bit of stage fright, but you still want to be involved, you can mm-hmm. do it.
That's exactly right. This is a great way to do it. And there are a lot of kids, by the time they become teenagers, that they know they want to work backstage. They want to be a techie, mm-hmm. you know, or a set designer, or they want to do costumes. And that's a whole art in itself. And so we've added that component. And we have, of course, a faculty that will be coming to handle all of the areas. We have a fully staffed group of people. Mr. Shelton Harden is the director, and he comes every summer. The kids just love him. He's completely versed in music and theater and dance, and so he is the coordinator of the whole camp. We have Mr. Jason Sacron and Joseph Rodriguez, who will be handling all of the art and set design. Then Miss Nancy Mathis and Miss Jenny Law will be handling all of the music, because the kids see throughout the day, they come from 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon, and throughout the day they have to go to a music piece where they learn their musical lines for this performance, because it is a musical production. And then they go to a time where they'll help with the set construction and the artwork. And then they will be going to dance, and that will be with Miss Jennifer Woodside Anderson. And this year, because of it being Robin Hood, there's going to be a lot of stage combat.
Oh, fun.
And so I know. I think I want to go to that piece. And so Jennifer will be teaching them correct stage combat. You know, that's an art in itself, to learn how to do that correctly on stage and not get hurt.
Right.
And so she'll be our choreographer, dancer, stage combat person. And then Miss Shannon Stoddard and our director Shelton will be handling the theater component. So, and then Miss Alicia Spears, she will also be coming on board to handle the 5-, 6-, 7-year-olds. Their whole music and theater and dance piece for the week. So we have a really great staff. A lot of the kids that have been involved before, they know this group of people. Some of these people work with us throughout the year. Most of them do. Most of them are on staff with us all year round. So the kids love this staff, and so we're expecting a large number of students. And we actually have a limit for each age group. We hope to have 100 students in camp this summer, and so we have a limit to each age group of 25 per group. So 25 5-, 6-, 7-year-olds, and then the age category of 8 through 11 will be 25 students, and then we go on up from there. So we would encourage people to register sooner than later.
So when the summer camp explosion starts, it's Monday morning, July 25th, 9 a.m.
That's correct.
You're going to go through the music. You're going to learn your lines. You're going to learn about stage combat. You're going to help mm-hmm. build the sets. And
yes.
then at the end, by the end of that week, is the production.
That's right.
Wow.
And the production is Friday evening, July 29th, and we do that at something called the Extreme Arts Kid Fest. And it's a free event, and this year we are actually doing it in the Breedlove Auditorium. All of our theater shows are now in Breedlove, and we're, you know, excited about that because we can set that stage up better with sets and backdrops, you know, and all of that. It's designed for theater. And so that's where the show will be. Extreme Arts Kid Fest is 6 o'clock in the evening on that Friday, July 29th. It's a free event for the entire community. It's a great evening for family. And following the performance, we go out onto the campus green and have watermelon and cake and a reception. And it's tons of fun.
It sounds like it.
So, anyway, and all the kids will be on stage performing. So we are currently registering students daily. And what they need to do is they can call us at 479-788-7251 or 7252. Or they can download registration forms either for Summer Camp Explosion or Kinder Kids Camp at www.uafortsmith.com. And spell out fortsmith.edu/academy, and just mail that right in to us, and we will get them enrolled. I should say, I mentioned all the faculty for Summer Camp Explosion. Miss Alice Sanders is our resident preschool instructor, and she's nationally certified in our preschool music garden program. So she handles all of the preschool classes throughout the school year in the summer and then handles summer camp. And she's really fantastic with very young children and with their parents. And it's just an excellent program. And I would encourage people, if they have a young child, a 3 or 4 year old, or a child that's about to turn 3, I would encourage them to bring their child to summer camp. It's a great place to start and find out if your child likes the arts. And most children just love it at that age.
Dr. Rosalie Walker-Russell is the executive director of the University of Arkansas Fort Smith Academy of the Arts. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Kyle. Good to talk to you.
And time now for a question. Today's winner will receive 2 tickets to see the legendary band Little Feat in concert at George's Majestic Lounge Saturday night at 9. You can find out more about the show at georgesmajesticlounge.com. Today is West Virginia Day, the day that state celebrates its creation as a state in 1863. It became a state when several counties in Virginia seceded from the Union to join the Confederacy. West Virginia was one of only 2 new states created during the Civil War. Our question today, what was the only other new state formed during the Civil War? Was it Minnesota, South Dakota, or Nevada? Call 800-522-5823 with your answer, and all correct answers will be placed inside the ceramic cow. One winner will be drawn, and the winner will receive 2 tickets to the Little Feat Show Saturday night at George's Majestic Lounge. Again, the only other state to be formed during the Civil War, joining the Union a few months after the creation of West Virginia. The choices are Minnesota, South Dakota, or Nevada. I bet you can get the right answer. Good luck.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 20th of June, 2011. It's the birthday of the poet Paul Muldoon, born in Portadown, Northern Ireland, 1951. He said of his childhood, the place was County Armagh, about halfway across Northern Ireland, an apple-growing district where some of the people who had been planted there in the Elizabethan era had come from Warwickshire and brought with them their apple plants, but also much of the language which William Shakespeare was using and which was fossilized where I was brought up. It's the birthday of Charles Waddell Chestnut, born in Cleveland, 1858. His parents were Southerners of mixed race who had left Fayetteville, North Carolina, for Ohio. Chestnut looked white, but he always identified as black. Family moved back to North Carolina when he was a boy. He went to a Freedmen's Bureau school for children of freed slaves, became a teacher, then a principal. He was established there in Fayetteville, but he thought he didn't have much of a future as a black writer in the South. So he moved back to Ohio, passed the state bar exam, set up a stenography business, became a court stenographer, and started writing stories for the Atlantic Monthly. 1899, his first book came out called The Conjure Woman, stories about clever slaves outwitting their cruel masters. They were written in dialect, filled with supernatural events. The book did well, and so did his next book, The Wife of His Youth and Other Stories of the Color Line, stories of middle-class, light-skinned characters of mixed race. Chestnut quit the stenography business, became a full-time writer, came out with three novels, which sold poorly. Readers considered them too angry, too radical. So he went back to stenography. And it's the birthday of Lillian Hellman, born New Orleans, 1905. She was 26 years old when she wrote her first play, The Children's Hour, story of two teachers, Karen and Martha, teach at an elite all-girls New England boarding school. A malicious student spreads a rumor that they are lesbian lovers, and their lives fall apart. Parents pull their students out of school. Martha commits suicide. It was a sensation when it was produced. It got rave reviews on Broadway, and it was the beginning of Lillian Hellman's celebrity. Here's a poem for today by John Barrowman, his Prayer for the Self. Who am I, worthless, that you spent such pains and take my pains again? I do not understand, but I believe. Jonquils respond with wit to the teasing breeze. Induct me down my secrets, stiffen this heart to stand their horrifying cries. Oh, cushion the first, the second shocks, will to a halt in midair there, demons who would be at me. May fade before sweet morning on sweet morning I wake my dreams, my fan mail go astray, and do me little goods I have not thought of, ingenious and beneficial Father. Ease in their passing, my beloved friends, all others too I have cared for in a traveling life, anyone, anywhere indeed, lift up, sober, toward truth, a scared self-estimate. A Prayer for the Self by John Barrowman from Love and Fame, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Novo Nordisk since 1923, combining drug discovery with technology to turn science into diabetes treatments at novonordisk-us.com. Produced by Kathy Roach and written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And it's time for the answer to today's question. The winner will eventually have two free tickets to Little Feet Saturday night beginning at 9 at George's Majestic Lounge on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. The question was, what was the only state other than West Virginia to be formed during the Civil War? And the answer is Nevada. It became the 34th state on October 31st, 1864. It was aligned with the Union and provided help in the national election just 8 days later of keeping Republicans in the majority in Washington throughout the end of the Civil War. Minnesota, by the way, had become a state 5 years before the war began. South Dakota would not become a state for another 25 years after the end of the Civil War. And to all of you West Virginians, happy West Virginia Day. We will pick a name from all the correct names that were put into the ceramic cow in just a moment. And if you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And this is a service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, KUAF, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Mulberry. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for tuning in. Tomorrow, another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large at noon. And you can learn more about the program and listen to stories again if you'd like at our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Have a pleasant Monday.